From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. He came into power with 80% of the vote behind him, heralding a peaceful revolution to rescue the poor majority of Venezuelans from decades of corrupt rule. 4 years later, Hugo Chavez's presidency has run aground in a paralyzing national strike. His popularity and hold on power have both plummeted. When the strike began 9 days ago, the Venezuelan Workers Union called for a non-binding referendum on the Chavez presidency. Since then, Venezuelan oil workers have cut production to a trickle. The National Guard is out, and a rally last week resulted in 3 deaths. Now opponents are calling for Chavez's resignation. Washington was sharply criticized for appearing to welcome a brief coup d'etat in April. Now it's keeping a low profile and watching the oil as the Persian Gulf heads toward political turmoil of its own. Tonight on Point, Venezuelan democracy and economy in deep trouble. Hugo Chavez was democratically elected. So should the U.S. just keep its hands off? In this post-Cold War world, how should Washington decide when and if to intervene? And is this class war or just a lousy leader in Venezuela? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Phil Gunson, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, reporting from Caracas. Good evening and welcome, Phil Gunson.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. Phil, give us a sense of what's happening today in the ninth day of this strike. What's the state of the nation?
Well, I can tell you what's happening right outside my window, which is a massive pot-banging protest. It's become the traditional way of protesting against President Chavez. But as the interview goes on, I'm sure listeners will probably be able to hear it because it tends to get louder and louder. The situation in the country is pretty desperate. The oil industry, as you were saying, is virtually paralyzed. The banks have joined the strike. Additional sectors seem to be joining it almost daily at the moment. The merchant navy is on strike. Airline pilots are on strike. The country is grinding to a halt because gasoline supplies are drying up. Food is holding up fairly well, but a lot of things that normally come into Caracas, for example, from outside the capital city, will undoubtedly start to dry up in the days ahead.
Phil Gunson, the call is for Hugo Chavez, the president, to stand for a new election or to simply stand down. But his term doesn't expire until January 2007. He was popular, we were told, not so very long ago. He was ousted briefly in April, came back to power. His palace was thronged with supporters at that time. What's going on here? What are the interests at play?
Well, there are a number of interests at play, obviously, but I suppose the overwhelming interest is the interest of what appears to be a very clear majority of the population who simply want him to go. He's proved to be a steadily more unpopular president as he's failed to resolve the deep-seated economic, structural economic problems of Venezuela. The poor are poorer today, ironically, than they were when Chavez came to power. The economy has shrunk over the last 4 years. But more than that, he's also attempting to impose on the majority of Venezuelans something that they really don't want, which is what he calls a revolution. And which is a kind of a mishmash of half-digested Marxism with some military nationalism and even a few threads of fascism thrown in there. And essentially what he is, in many respects, is a traditional Latin American caudillo, a traditional Latin American military strongman.
Riding tall in the saddle, who's to say that Venezuelans don't want this revolution?
Well, the opinion polls certainly say they don't, and street demonstrations involving hundreds of thousands of people, 2 million signatures for a consultative referendum is what they call it, which is scheduled for February, but which the government says it won't respect and is illegal and unconstitutional. Those are the kinds of indications that we have that really, apart from the pot-banging protest outside my window, that the Venezuelans really want to see the back of Hugo Chavez.
Is this at heart a kind of class war? Did Chavez go after long-time entrenched aristocratic interests in Venezuela who then managed to rally a bunch of people around them? But is it at heart a war between the classes? He likes to present it that way sometimes.
He certainly does like to present it that way. And, of course, there's a grain of truth to it. Most of Chavez's remaining supporters, who may be perhaps 25, 30% of the population, not an insignificant number of people at all, are concentrated in the very poorest sectors of society. Mm-hmm. Although even there, he's lost a lot of support over the last year. Poverty specialists say that, although, of course, you can have as much poverty as you want in the sense that it depends where you draw the line, that approximately 65% of Venezuelans live in poverty. And so if Chavez has a 70% disapproval rate, clearly he's lost a lot of support among the poor.
But is this an example of a democratically elected leader trying to change an economic structure that has for many, many years favored an economically privileged class and just running into so many entrenched interests, even the better paid workers of the oil industry, the airline pilots, the aluminum workers who might be better off than farmers, just running into entrenched interests who don't want to see a more level distribution of resources in Venezuela?
Well, ironically enough, for example, the well-paid oil workers, and they are well-paid by Venezuelan standards, and they recently had a 40% increase given to them by the government. Mm-hmm. Many of them, that's to say, the workers at the who are actually pumping the oil rather than the administrative staff who are almost universally anti-Chavez, many of those workers are actually on the side of the government. The opposition to Chavez is very evenly spread across society. And when Chavez talks about an oligarchy, I think it's important to realize that, strictly speaking, there never has been an oligarchy in Venezuela. This has been a country which, although there are rich and there are poor, there's never been a class which has combined economic wealth and political power and which has persisted through generations, as it does, for example, in neighboring Colombia. Here, there's been a lot more social mobility. People who have money in one generation don't necessarily have it in the next, and so on.
So how do we get out of this situation? What's the climb down path here? Is there one?
Well, Chavez doesn't seem to have any intention of climbing down. In fact, quite the reverse. He seems to think that this situation is an opportunity. He talks about 2002 as the year of the consolidation of the revolution. He believes in an historic break with representative democracy, which he dismisses as an old and outmoded form of democracy. He says he believes in participatory democracy, which appears to mean, at least to judge by what happened last night and is happening again tonight, sending mobs out onto the street, for example, to threaten and in some cases to trash the offices of media organizations.
Participatory democracy, indeed. Phil Gunson, stand by. I want to welcome in the studio here in Boston Ricardo Hausman. He's a professor of the practice of economic development at Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and was minister of planning in Venezuela in the early 1990s. Good evening and welcome, Ricardo Hausman.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's very good to have you. So you're sitting here a long way from Caracas. I'm sure you're watching very intently. What's your interpretation of what's going on? You've got a democratically elected president there. His term isn't up until 2007. Popular or not, why shouldn't he stay or should he stay?
Well, you know, besides winning an election, a president has to, you know, abide by the Constitution and the laws, and, you know, he has to play ball. He's violating every single law in the book. He has a mountain of accusations against him, but they're all sitting in the office of the Attorney General, who he controls, and so they're not being processed. There's a massive obstruction of justice. So there's many, many things that he has done that are completely outside the law. He has subverted the division of powers. He has subverted the electoral power that is supposed to organize elections. He has subverted the judicial power. He has subverted the process of decentralization in federal government. He has taken over the Caracas police in order to take the protection out of the citizens so that they will be more vulnerable to the armed gangs that Phil was talking about. So this is really what's at stake in Venezuela is not a class warfare. What's at stake in Venezuela is democracy. And in the Chavez mentality, he has defined a world in which the people are good and the leader is good, and then there are the enemies of the people. And what's happened over Well, what's happened over the last 4 years is that more and more of society has been defined as the enemies of the people. So right now the enemies of the people are 80% of the people.
Mr. Hausman, with all respect, you look like a well-heeled son, probably of Venezuelan privilege. Did you ever support Hugo Chavez?
I personally never supported Hugo Chavez, but I am a good example of Venezuela. My parents migrated with no education. I'm the first person in my whole family to have ever gone to university, and I'm now a Harvard professor.
So I stand fully corrected there. And you look at him and you see not a democratic leader, but an anti-democratic leader who got elected.
An anti-democratic leader who organized two military coup attempts in the early 90s, and each military coup attempt, there were hundreds of deaths. These were not military coups after massive rallies or anything. These were things that were organized at 2 a.m. in the morning, in which armed troops tried to storm the presidential palace. So that's how he got elected. One lesson for Venezuelans.
No, wait, but he didn't get elected plotters or coup. He got elected by Venezuelan voters.
Right. So he organized those two coups. Like Hitler, he went to jail. Like Fidel Castro, he went to jail after trying to organize a coup.
But he was
elected.
What did that represent?
Why,
that electoral victory. Why was Hugo Chavez initially elected?
Yes, that's an excellent question. Venezuela has had a horrible economic performance over the last 20 years, after being the economy that had the highest rate of growth over the previous 60 years. So Venezuela, between 1920 and 1980, was the most successful country in the world in terms of development and so on.
Boom.
In fact, in the 50s, Venezuela had 600,000 migrants from Italy, Portugal, Spain.
I think that's still the impression of many Americans, even today when it's long outmoded, perhaps.
Right. But imagine Europeans were going to Venezuela because they thought that their prospects in Venezuela were going to be better. And that's what gives the social mobility that the previous speaker was mentioning. So fantastic growth, a lot of development, and suddenly 20 horrible years.
Why? Oil is still relatively expensive?
Well, for several reasons. But oil revenues have declined very significantly relative to what they were.
Yes.
And then we mismanaged. We did not get our act together. I don't have the time right now to could go on forever on that. But that's not the question you asked. So obviously, in that period of 20 years, we had a stable two-party democracy with a Christian Democratic Party in the center-right, a Social Democratic Party in the center-left, and the left-wing parties that would get 7% of the vote and so on.
And growing poverty, growing unease.
As the economy deteriorated. Say, in 1980, poverty rates were under 20%, and now they are probably above 50%. So this deterioration is recent. And this deterioration meant that at each election, people wanted to kick the rascals out.
Chavez.
The two traditional parties lost power in 1993. The previous president was of the left-wing parties. And Chavez got elected because of a frustration with the whole political system. Say, we want to kick out the whole political system. Now, that was a vote against the perception of mismanagement and corruption. But since the situation has worsened, people have said, well, we made a mistake. This was not the way
out. Let's turn it around. Stand by. Phil Gunson there in Caracas. Do you share this view that this president has violated the law, violated the Constitution, subverted the democracy that brought him to power?
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, the irony is that he's subverted and violated the Constitution that he himself created via an assembly in which 98% of the votes were votes for him. So he's fond of saying that this is the most wonderful constitution in the world. And in fact, in virtually every speech he makes, he pulls out a little copy of the constitution, a little blue book, which is like his little red book of Chairman Mao or Colonel Gaddafi's green book. And he waves it to show, you know, how wonderful it is. And he's always instructing people to read it and learn it and practice it. But he's been its biggest violator.
And he's not standing down. Where are we headed? Are we headed to some kind of civil war? How might that play out?
Well, I don't think we're headed for civil war, at least I sincerely hope not, but I do think there's a serious problem of violence, I mean a serious prospect of violence, unless somehow, and it seems very unlikely at the moment, President Chavez backs down. As I say, he sees this situation at present more as an opportunity than as a threat. He seems to be left unmoved by the fact that the country is virtually paralyzed, and what he sees is the prospect of finally defeating what he sees as the representatives of evil. I mean, he genuinely believes, and he said many times, that this is a battle between good and evil.
Phil Gunson, stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking about crisis in Venezuela, a democracy, an economy, an oil supplier in trouble. Hugo Chavez was democratically elected. Does that mean the U.S. should just keep its hands off, period? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about crisis in Venezuela, a democracy, an economy, an oil supplier in trouble. The question is, post-Cold War, how and when should the U.S. decide when and if it should intervene in a country like Venezuela? Should it at all? Is this class war or just a lousy leader? And how deeply rooted is democracy in Venezuela if the country is so ready to kick out an elected leader 5 years before the end of his term? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us. I'm joined in the studio by Ricardo Hausmann, former minister of planning in Venezuela in the early 1990s, and from Caracas, Venezuela, by reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, Phil Gunson. Phil Gunson, from the Caracas perspective, what do you see of U.S. fingerprints, if any? Is the United States getting involved? Is it staying out? What's the interaction?
Well, in April, the United States was involved to some extent, and I think it's clear from their joy, I think would not be too strong a word, when Chavez was kicked out.
Are you saying they were involved in planning or facilitating the coup, or simply in applauding it once it occurred?
Well, first of all, I think it's questionable to what extent there was a coup. I mean, certainly in shorthand terms, there was a coup. But it's a very complex thing to analyze. For one thing, what many people don't realize is that the people who asked Chavez to resign were his own high command. And the head of the armed forces at the time, who went on TV and said, we've asked the president to resign and he has accepted, was subsequently made defense minister when Chavez came back. So,
fair enough, but he was in an island prison, no longer in the presidential palace. It had the looks of a coup.
It's perfectly true, but it's a very complex issue, mm-hmm. and the reasons why Chavez lost the support of his armed forces at that point are quite complex to explain.
But are you saying that Washington was in the middle of this, encouraging this action, or simply approving when it happened?
Yeah, I'm certainly saying that they encouraged it, and I'm sure. Totally convinced that they were involved in discussions with people who were planning ways in which Chavez could be removed from power as far as possible within the Constitution. I'm not saying that this was a coup organized by Washington the way that Washington organized and orchestrated the removal of Salvador Allende in 1973, for example, but they were certainly happy to see it. And I think they were very frightened when, for example, after the April events, Christopher Dodd's office in the Senate threatened them with an investigation. And that, the way they got their fingers burned then, because, of course, Chavez came back to power,
yes.
So they were left in a very bad situation, that has made them back off for the last several months and has put them in a much more difficult situation than they were before.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing for Venezuela? I guess I should put that to Ricardo Hausmann. Do you think the United States is playing an appropriate role by standing back from the crisis in Caracas?
I think that the U.S. is playing an appropriate role. This is a problem between Venezuelans. The international community has played a very constructive role. The opposition wants a democratic way out. They are calling for elections. They think that the government should have the support of the people, and they want the people to be consulted in the context of a very severe crisis. So the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, a very important person, has essentially been living in a hotel in Caracas for the last 30 days trying to broker an agreement. And I think that that's a good way for the international community in a multilateral way to get involved in trying to find the solution in the country.
Would this be a constitutional solution, or are people saying the Constitution's been so twisted around that it doesn't matter anymore? We just need an election. Does the Constitution allow for such a midterm election?
The Constitution, first of all, the Constitution allows for a president to resign. When the president loses the confidence of the people, the Constitution says that the president has the freedom to resign. The Constitution says that the president can be impeached if he violates the law. Now, right now, the government is the government party is doing everything they can to subvert the Supreme Court so that the Supreme Court does not act against the president.
In fact, the Supreme Court suspended its work today.
Yes, because Congress tried to undermine the appointed judges so that they would not act against the president. So there are many. The problem in Venezuela is not that there is no constitutional way out. The problem in Venezuela is that there is no balance of power in which the constitution can be applied, because if the constitution were applied, he would be out. He would probably be in jail.
Ricardo Hausman, what are the risks here? What may unfold if this isn't settled somehow and soon?
Well, this is very serious, because while the opposition has played civil disobedience, nonviolence, and there has been no violence, to my knowledge, on the opposition side, the government has a more, if you want, a fascist approach. They have armed gangs that they use to intimidate the press, to intimidate the opposition.
And protesters, people have died.
And people have died. But it's not that protesters. This was a group of people who went and shot directly at people gathered in a square.
Mm-hmm.
Three people died. Almost 30 people got bullet wounds. And in that context, the responsible people the investigation is being subverted.
So where are we headed if this isn't solved?
I think that we are headed to violence until something puts a stop to this presidency. But I hope that the pressure of the international community is going to be sufficiently hard to force a solution. I think that what the opposition is asking for is saying, look, we want an election in the first quarter of next year, mm-hmm. and if Chavez wants to run, he has to run from outside of government. He has to resign and run as another candidate, because if he runs from the presidency, he will use all the powers of the presidency he will abuse all the powers of the presidency.
But Phil Gunson, no sign at this point that President Chavez is prepared to do that.
No, there isn't. In fact, he said repeatedly that he won't resign, and although last night there was a slight sense that the government negotiators at the talks that Cesar Gaviria, the Secretary General of the OAS, has been chairing, they did suggest that they might put on the table an election timetable. It really seems that they're using these talks as a way to play for time in the hope that they can break this strike and break the opposition.
Phil Gunson, Ricardo Hausman, stand by. A lot of people want to join this conversation. I'm going to turn to them. Mercedes is on the line. Welcome, Mercedes. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was just calling to thank you to finally have a program on Venezuela. We've been going through this crisis for a year. It's been intensifying for a long time.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about here.
Yes, definitely. Chavez has been violating the Constitution for a long time. He's a type of president that was elected, yes, and he was elected because your guests have said before, the poverty has gotten worse, and with his populist rhetoric, like it's happening in Brazil and it's happened in Ecuador, people will believe whatever anybody want to tell them.
Are you Venezuelan, Mercedes, may I ask?
Yes, I am Venezuelan. I've been in this country for 23 years, though.
Mm-hmm. And your family here or there?
My whole family is over there. My whole family is part of the opposition. The opposition, you should mention, is organized under an umbrella name that is called the Democratic Coordinator. And that gathers the old parties, political parties, and new political parties that have come up.
Mercedes, let me ask you, though, did the previous political parties deserve Hugo Chavez for not delivering to help out the Venezuelans in poverty?
Yes, in some ways we do. We recognize that. However, democracy for us is the most important thing. And we had democracy since 1958, and now we have generations that have grown up in democracy. And when we recognize his actions as being totally anti-democratic, from wanting to control the private schools that we assisted, that he wanted to change the curriculum, he changed the name of the country, he wanted to change history, he started to attack different sectors of the society. He actually said in one of his speeches, which I don't know if you know, that he would go on the radio and TV for 5 hours straight and start attacking different sectors of the society. And he said that private property was not sacred. And he actually allowed people to go into people's farms or areas and just take over. And he's been, since he got into power, creating a situation where that we never had before, where people are actually from different classes are hating each other.
And all this with the portrait of Simon Bolivar over his shoulder, his kind of patron saint. Mercedes, thanks for painting the picture for us and for calling. I want to welcome to our conversation, also from Caracas, Nicholas Kristof, columnist for the New York Times, just up from Argentina, from where he was writing a column in the paper this morning. Good evening and welcome, Nick Kristof.
Thank you.
Nick, thanks for joining us. I know you've been in Buenos Aires looking at what's going on there and writing about all of South America as a potential kind of basket case, unbelievably, as you describe it, teetering on following the path of Africa, sliding from a continent headed toward second and first world status to a continent toying with third world status again.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's my broadest concern, that really until now, if you look at the developing world, then in almost every place there's been some hope, some sense of progress, with the exception of Africa, where per capita incomes have just been, you know, mired in stagnation or worse for almost 40 years. But now in Latin America, there's a real sense, especially South America, I'd say, not so much Mexico, but beginning in Central America and on South, you know, in much of the region, with the exception of, say, Chile and a couple of places, there is a real sense of economic catastrophe, and in places like Argentina, a sense of falling from the first world to the third.
You say in your column this morning, all of South America is in crisis. How do you see Venezuela fitting into that picture, Nick Kristof?
Well, in Venezuela, you had, I mean, ironically, Venezuela is really a place that, by historical standards, has been unusually stable in political terms over the last 44 years or so. But as a result of this kind of an economic distress, the sense among a lot of the people, among the, you know, the working class, that they weren't participating in any of the economic development, you had this emergence of a elected figure who isn't really terribly democratic, even though he emerges by democratic means. And you have something similar in terms of the rise of kind of populist politicians, also recently in Ecuador, Lula in Brazil. I think we're not exactly sure how to deal with these kinds of figures, and both politically and also economically, with the end of support for kind of Washington consensus market-oriented economic policies.
I guess we're prepared to believe that Washington is simply preoccupied with events in the United States and in the Middle East. What could, should Washington be doing, in your view, Nick Kristof, that it's not?
I think the central issue is engagement, that we have to be fundamentally involved, I mean, A, in this crisis in Venezuela, because it probably is not going to be solved by itself. And, I mean, other countries have to be, Brazil has to be involved, Lula has to play a role here, but the U.S. has to be putting pressure on both sides. And I think that more broadly, for example, in Argentina, I think we need to push the IMF and push Argentina towards some kind of a new IMF agreement. The concern is that Argentina has already defaulted on its commercial and World Bank debt, and if it's just Argentina, the system can, to some extent, live with it. But there is a real risk that others will follow with defaults, including conceivably Brazil, and that would be an immense shock to the global economic system.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. I'm Gina Cervetti, and in the studio with me this evening is Steve Ellman. He's our assistant general manager. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Gina.
And also, Fred Tice is here. Fred's one of our reporters at WBUR. Hi there,
Hi,
Fred.
Gina.
Just a reminder to those of you who've tuned in to hear this wonderful conversation and very informative conversation from On Point, that On Point is a program that's here, a relatively new program to the air of WBUR, but here because people like you have made a pledge for the news, a pledge for your favorite programs, and our fundraiser that we're currently in ends tomorrow. We hope that you've made a pledge. If not, pick up the phone and do that now.
And the sorts of things that you hear on Point when you send your pledge at 1-800-909-9287, the kinds of things that you hear are the sorts of things you just heard a few moments ago. On Point producers were able to get Nicholas Kristof just about an hour after he touched down in Caracas and got him to a phone and got him into the show, got him into the conversation. It's that kind of conversation about breaking events around the world, also about some of the bigger currents and of events around the world. It's not always the breaking news, but this is this incredibly interesting 2 hours that you get every night from 7 to 9 p.m. that you pay for when you make that pledge at 1-800-909-9287.
You know, the truth is that term content rich is very, very appropriate for On Point. The pace of information that you get is really unlike any other program. And if you've come away from the show with something useful, something valuable, something meaningful, we hope that you'll give something back now with that pledge. By this time tomorrow night, we'll be wrapping up the WBUR year-end fundraiser, and we need your pledge to do it. We have $132,000 to go. We'd like to raise it all before the fundraiser ends, so we won't have to add time to the fundraiser scheduled for next year. So your pledge right now really will help us stay on target. 1-800-909-9287.
It only takes just a few minutes to make a pledge for the news. If you've been tuning in over the past several days during the fundraiser and have continued to listen, then we want to pause now to encourage you to pledge. We hope also that you've taken the opportunity to renew your commitment to your favorite programs. If not, do so now. 1-800-909-9287.
I'm Ira Glass, and consider for a moment, please, what a bargain public radio is, even if you pick up the phone and pledge. And one of the quickest ways to fully comprehend what a bargain we're offering you with public radio is to try and sign up for cable TV.
Thank you for calling. How may I help you?
Yeah, hi. I'm calling, and I'm recording this for a possible broadcast. I'd like to sign up for cable. I'd like to find out what it would cost.
What city are you in?
Here in Chicago.
The basic services is $31.49 a month before tax.
$31.49. That's more than $1 a day. A lot of money. And consider for a moment all of the things that you get with public radio that you don't even get with cable TV. The operator at the cable company listed all the options for me.
$74.99 will give you all 6 movie channels. Cinemax, TMC, HBO, Showstars, and Encore.
Let me just ask you, if I were to get, say, the $60 option, the
$59.99, mm-hmm.
That's $59.99 a month, right?
Right, $64.27 with tax.
$64.27 a month with tax.
Correct.
Now, could I arrange so you guys would send me like a coffee mug or something with that every month?
Pardon me?
You'd send me, you know, like a coffee mug or some sort of gift with that every month for the $64?
Unfortunately, no.
No. You give 60 or 70 bucks at most public radio stations, and we send you all kinds of stuff. Mugs and T-shirts and tote bags. You know, it's all different levels, but it's, you know, it's kind of around there. As I understand it, I sign up for cable. The cable company makes me pledge $780 per year. Friend, you give $780 to most public radio stations, they give you your own program. All right, I exaggerate, but they do act really, really, really nice to you. One more thing about the superiority of public radio over cable television. You know what would be really handy to have cable? In the car. You got all that time in your hands. Public radio, you know, we're there for you in the car where you need it. Or let's say you go for a stroll wearing a Walkman. We're there with you. Cable TV? No chance. On the subway, cable TV? Don't make me laugh.
And back to On Point.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about crisis in Venezuela, a democracy, an economy, and an oil supplier in trouble. Post-Cold War, how and when should the U.S. decide when and if it should intervene? And at this point, will anything shy of a halt in oil in the oil flow get Washington involved? Should it? Why is oil-rich Venezuela still falling short of stability? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined in the studio by former Minister of Planning in Venezuela, currently professor in the practice of economic development at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, Ricardo Hausman, and from Caracas, Venezuela, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. Juan is calling us right now from Worcester, Mass. Hi, Juan. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. I am also from Venezuela. I have been living in the U.S. for almost 20 years now.
All right.
And part of the reason why this is happening is complacency. Complacency from our part as a society not to do anything until now.
When you say our, do you mean Venezuelans'
yes,
part?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I can, believe me, I can close my eyes, I can turn the clock back, probably 20 years, and I remember before when I left the country, we were talking about exactly the same things that we are talking now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem that is coming from 40 years ago. Lack of planning. The people that get elected, they don't see the country as a country. They see it as their own. And what they do is they work on 4 or 5 year cycles. They know that whatever I'm going to do now in 5 years, the next party that comes is going to wipe out everything. I'm going to lose my job. So I have to make the most out of it right now until the next election comes. And that has been the problem. We have been used to working in cycles. And people in government, of course, I mean, there is so much money coming into the country.
So no one's planning for the next time around. Juan, thank you for your call. Nick Kristof in Caracas. You hear a Venezuelan beating up on Venezuela, saying we haven't been responsible, we've been complacent. Is that fair, or is there a bigger envelope here that the international community has to answer for?
Well, I mean, I do think that by and large, it is South Americans themselves, I mean, whether Venezuelans or Argentinians or Brazilians, mm-hmm. who do primarily have to answer for the things that have gone wrong economically. I think that above all, I would emphasize the corruption. That, you know, why did free market policies not work in these places? Well, one important reason was that the level of corruption has been unbelievable in each place, and that not only undermined the efficiency of the economy, but it also antagonized the ordinary public. And mm-hmm. I mean, the one thing I guess I would say though about it on the American side is that I think in implementing these policies, maybe we should have been more alert to the risk that a lot of money was going to be siphoned off.
And we're not. You say Treasury Secretary, the new Treasury Secretary, John Snow, has to wake up to America's international responsibilities to sustain economic order at this point.
I think that is very clear. I think that the administration is very focused, understandably, on other parts of the world, but the world just doesn't work that way. We can't only be focused on just one part of it, because if things go badly wrong here in South America, if we lose South America, so to speak, and I think that we are kind of losing the struggle to have sound economic policies here, then we will indeed pay a price for years to come.
Juan, thank you for your call. Steve is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hello. I kind of tuned in a little late, but I just wanted to bring up the question of whether or not the recent strikes really accurately represent discontent in Venezuela. Like, if I recall correctly, the workers got the same pay, if not more, to stay home versus going to work. So I'm questioning whether or not there's really a sacrifice involved in the strikes. And even with that, there were some earlier strikes that failed during the time of the attempted coup. So I just wanted to see how the panelists would respond to that, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Let's ask them. Thanks for your call, Steve. Ricardo Hausman, how about it? Is there real passion behind this strike, or is it just as easy to stay home as to go to work? The pay is the same. Is that right?
Well, I think that there is passion behind the strike. There are many, many small shop owners and employees that are striking. There's many people who are working in these organizations putting their whole careers on the line, say captains in ships, oil industry managers and so on, who are being forced by the government to do things that they don't want to do and are putting their careers on the line. They've been fired. They're being threatened. So every day there is a rally and people march for miles, hundreds of thousands of people. Every evening they go and bang pots at 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot. There's a swelling movement of support. And when you try to manipulate, say, when the CIA organized coups in Latin America, mm-hmm. those coups happened at 10 p.m. at night or at 6 a.m. in the morning by having some army guys take over the presidential palace. It was not hundreds of thousands of people protesting against a government. It's very hard to manipulate hundreds of thousands of people into doing that. There has to be a real sense of a disappointment, a real sense of being wronged in order to generate this kind of passion.
Ricardo Hausman, we hear you saying throughout the hour that this is likely to go to violence if Hugo Chavez does not do something unexpected, like step down and stand for re-election voluntarily. If things go in that direction, you've described him as a fascist, you've compared him to Hitler. Where does Venezuela's military stand? Is it likely in the end to side with opposition to Hugo Chavez or to stay on his side? Can you tell?
Well, I think that it's very hard to read the military, and I think that they probably themselves don't know where they stand, and they have doubts about what everybody is saying. But let me go back a second to the parallel with Germany. What is similar to Germany is the fact that we had a horrible decade of the 20s in Germany that undid the traditional political parties, and people were willing to go for somebody who represented a radical break. Mm-hmm. And once they got that somebody elected to power, he subverted the presidential power and took over total power, and he probably lost the support of the people by then, but there was no democracy, there was no internet, there were no media to allow people to organize against a disruptive government.
Nick Kristof in Caracas, we've been told by all our guests tonight that this is not class war. It's something else. It's real disgruntlement with Hugo Chavez. Do you buy that? And does the traditional kind of ruling class in South America, is it prepared to address a bit of redistribution of resources if that's what's required to go forward with stability?
I've just been in Venezuela. I just got in, and so I would strongly discount my answers compared to those who know the country better. Having said that, I mean, I take their point, but I do think that there is a real element of frustration on the part of a lot of Chavez supporters, a lot of workers who feel that they, you know, that they have been overlooked and neglected for a long time, and that it's class warfare is too strong, but that there is certainly, it seems to me, an element of that kind of class antagonism, not only here, but also in Brazil and Argentina, for example. And I think that is indeed dangerous. Now, whether that can be addressed, seems to me the best way of doing that is precisely with market-oriented policies. But I, unfortunately, think those policies are really being discredited.
It sounds like a rough road ahead. Nick Kristof, thanks so much for joining us tonight from Caracas. It's been great to have you.
Sure, my pleasure.
Nicholas Kristof is columnist for the New York Times, and Ricardo Hausman here in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in, and thanks for all your perspective.
Thank you.
Ricardo Hausman is professor of the practice of economic development at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's former minister of planning in Venezuela. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and by Nortec, creating building products to help improve the comfort and security of homes and workplaces around the world. Essex Partners, providing career advice, consulting services, and new opportunities to senior executives in transition, in Boston and on the web at essexpartners.com. The forecast tonight, partly cloudy skies, low temperatures in the lower 20s, cloudy tomorrow with highs in the upper 30s, then tomorrow night, snow or rain, an inch or less of snow accumulation, low temperatures tomorrow night in the lower 30s. Thursday, rain or snow in the morning, then partly cloudy skies with high temperatures in the upper 30s. WBUR supporters also include the Museum of Science, now showing the quest for immortality, treasures of ancient Egypt, including over 100 artifacts some never seen outside of Egypt, on the web at mos.org/quest. Audi, the full Audi line, including the redesigned A4, the A6, and the TT convertible, available at local Boston area Audi dealers. And Super Salad Boston with 10 area locations and on the web at supersaladboston.com. Super Salad Boston, where something delicious happens every day.
With me, Neil Partrick, war stage one, or is this just heightened security? Well, I think in a curious way, it's a bit of both.
Let's go back to what Senator Daschle said on the floor of the Senate yesterday.
The president is quoted in the Washington Post this morning as saying that the Democratic-controlled Senate...
Reporters stationed all over the world providing up-to-the-minute information. $12.8 million a year.
A global satellite intercommunication system providing crystal-clear sound from anywhere on the planet. $6.9 million a year.
Being able to access all this anytime you please by simply turning on your radio. Priceless.
Priceless, my foot!
Well, it may be priceless to you, but all this stuff costs us money.
So it's no longer priceless. We're putting a price on it. And that price is a measly,
minuscule,
infinitesimal,
eensy-weensy, teeny-weeny
$5 a month.
That's right. For a mere $5 a month, you can support all of the priceless, priceless to you, information you get from WBUR.
So please call now and pledge your diminutive $5 a month or more if you can afford it.
The number to call is 800-909-9287.
Or you can pledge online at WBUR.org.
Oh, if it only were priceless, right, Steve?
Oh, it is priceless, but we have to put a price on it from time to time.
Steve Ellman is our assistant general manager, and he's with me, Gina Cervetti, in the studio. Fred Tice is a reporter for WBUR, and he's here as well. We're here to remind you of the important role that you play in the kinds of programs that you hear on WBUR. As our year-end fundraiser comes very quickly to a close tomorrow, we certainly hope that you've picked up the phone and made your pledge.
It is the end of the calendar year, the time of the year when you think about organizations that matter to you. As Tom and Ray suggested, if you can make a gift of $60, $5 a month, we'd very much appreciate that, putting WBUR on your list. If you have the capacity for perhaps a different kind of price, a larger gift, $5,000 or $10,000, we hope that you'll consider WBUR because really what we do is priceless. There's no way to put a price on it. We just ask you to think about what it's worth to you. 1-800-909-9287.
But you, the listener, do play a very important role in what happens in public radio. You're the public in public radio broadcasting, and really it's a unique relationship that exists between you, the listener, and the radio station. We have to come to you occasionally and remind you of this, and hopefully you heed the call and pick up the phone and make your contribution for your favorite programs.
It's your radio station, and by calling 1-800-909-9287, you can keep the kinds of programming that you want to hear on this radio station, the kind of programming that you're tuning into right now, on point, to marvelous hours of intelligent conversation involving great guests and, of course, our very great listeners who call in, our supporters here at WBUR, who contribute both on air, but to whom we have to ask to contribute from time to time financially as well. So please call 1-800-909-9287.
The second hour of On Point is coming right up, preceded by the headlines. But we do have these messages for you. The fundraiser is quickly coming to an end. In just a few minutes, the second last day will be over. We'll have one more day, a day in which we want to raise about $130,000. We are doing very well, but we need to raise that all before the fundraiser ends tomorrow, so we won't have to add time to fundraisers scheduled for next year. So if you've been thinking about that pledge, now is the time to put it into action. 1-800-909-9287.
And think about it. It's 2 hours a night, but 500 hours of fantastic programming throughout the year on point. Put a price on that and then make your contribution. Is it worth $5 a month, $10, or $25 a month?
If you've pledged, thanks. If not, this is a great time to do it. If you can afford a $365 pledge, $1 a day for the news, that will be very helpful, and you'll be eligible for the WBUR fleece jacket when you do.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rugs. Three generations spent educating people in the art and culture of Oriental rugs. Gregorian's a little part of Persia in Newton Lower Falls. Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions. Thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy. CMS.